The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Start off by looking at two important aspects of parenting, and I'm going to call these vitamin E and vitamin C. Vitamin E are the executive functions of parenting, the control things, restraint, things like structure, limit setting, monitoring, discipline, guidance, those things that we don't like doing. And vitamin C are what I'm calling the caring functions. These are the closeness continuum. Things like support, nurturance, praise, closeness, warmth, love, and affection. We can put these on a grid. So vitamin E would be this control continuum. We have from rigid control to chaotic, no control. And then vitamin C would be proximity, closeness, from so close you're enmeshed to disengaged. And you're going to flesh each of these out, right?
All right, we're going to talk a little bit about those. So, let's start. Do you got this concept here so far? Are we... hands, people who are getting it. Let's go over again. Okay. Rigid. What does that mean? Doesn't move. Narrow. Kind of restricted. Okay. Chaotic. What does it mean? It's pretty crazy. All right. It's all over the place. So here it's regimented. Here it's crazy. As you move up towards the top, it gets crazier. As you move down towards the bottom, it gets more rigid. The people way down the bottom here, very regimented up the top. You don't even know what they're doing. They're all over the place. Enmeshed, right here. They're eating each other's food. They talk for each other. They may bathe together. It's not good. All right? They do lots of stuff together. Over here, they're so disengaged, they're barely a family. They don't touch each other. They're just unconnected. Okay. So now I'm going to go over the quadrants here, and what the families would look like that would fit in here, okay?
Do you want this?
Yeah. Let's put it up here. Now, before I put this up, as we go through this, think a little bit about the family that you came from. That's right. Think about your early years and what that was like, and then think a little bit about the family that you're in now. And as we go through these items, try to picture, get a feel for that anyway, okay? Okay, so the chaotic, disengaged family. This is the disintegrating family. Okay, we're going to start right up here. First thing is that they have an inability to get things done. Things get broken and they don't get fixed. People need to go places, they don't get there. Things need to happen in the family, they don't. Goals are made, they're not accomplished. People go their separate ways. They don't know where the kids are, they don't know where the dog's been for the last couple weeks. Nobody's fed the dog. Can't find the baby, they don't have diapers. I'm making extremes here, but it's a transitional state, allows everyone to do his or her own thing. They ask questions like, why can't I have a gun? There's just not a lot of boundaries up here. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty chaotic. Now, if the people in the family were billiard balls, they would be, well, sort of like that. They're on the floor in different places, and is there an order to it or a reason? Is there a focus? Is there a goal? Is there a sense of togetherness? No. It's just sort of all over the place. They don't eat together, maybe. They may not play together. There's not a lot of rules. There's no accountability. There's no sense of belonging. Interesting enough, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit, that a lot of, we're seeing more and more families like that. As families break down, they kind of head in that direction. Okay, do you have a sense of that quadrant? So we're going to come back and try to figure out what kind of families. You might be thinking about TV programs or movies or things like that as we go through here, because we're going to try to fit some of those into this when we're done. Okay, the chaotic enmeshed is right over here. They have an inability to get things done, yet they're very dependent on each other. They're linked in some way, but the linking doesn't work. People can be upset with each other and in some way linked, and they may be emotional reacting to each other, but whatever it is they need to get done, it still doesn't get done. Limits aren't set. There's role reversal. Sometimes the kids are doing things for the parents that the parents should do. The kids are parenting the parents in some way. The kids write their own excuse notes for school. I had a kid who did his parents' taxes one year. Interesting stuff happens. Problems pile up and they never get resolved. There's basically a constant crisis. Something is just going on every second. So there's an emotional roller coaster. People are up and down. This family is sort of constant internal turmoil. There's always a new crisis where everybody's involved in getting something done. And there's not a lot of manipulation. Now, the balls, these are people in the family, the balls are bunched together, but they're not in any particular order. They're all touching, sort of, but there's no real focus or order. They're just sort of bunched up. And you ask the question, why do we do this in our family? Well, we just do. There's not meaning, there's not purpose, there's not focus. Okay? And what happens if you hit one? What happens if you hit one of the balls?
Yeah,
they all bounce all over the place. So it's very sort of a reactive sort of thing. They react off each other. So tight that they react off. There's not room for individual feelings, emotions, that kind of thing sometimes. Okay, the next is rigid, disengaged. Now here the balls, or the people in the family, are in a very orderly fashion. They're lined up according to number, maybe. Okay, we got a 1, we got a 2, we got a 3, we got a 4, we got a 5, we got a 6. They're in order, but, I'm sorry, they're not touching each other, that's right. There's distance there. There's a distance between them. This is the family in name only. Inflexible objectives. This is the family where you do the things that you're supposed to do. These are a lot of oughts, shoulds, should always be nice, should never. Often there's a lot of high expectations too. Because the family doesn't relate in relationships, and again, I think this is maybe a rule, but as relationship goes down, rules often go up. Okay? Low relationship, high rules. High relationship, less rules. Okay? So here you have lots and lots of rules. There's no negotiation. People just make unilateral decisions. You might have a dictatorship, or you might have people like band together to take over in some way. Extreme preparedness with little margin for crisis and little in common. Again, there's some sense of values, but their meaning together, because of the lack of relationship, is not there. Okay. The rigid enmeshed is the mafia. All the balls are they're in order, and they're by number, and they're all touching each other, too. It can be like a little military, you know? This is where the family is ruthless in meeting their objectives. They expect a lot from each other. the lines are pretty well drawn, and they're real close to each other. This is where, when they kiss you, you're going to die. Okay? You know? This is a family that you don't want them really kissing you, because it's not the best thing. Real high expectations, no negotiation, extreme preparedness, and harsh consequences for people who don't follow the rules. You know, the rules are there and people know it, and if you don't follow the rules in the mafia, you know, you find yourself at the bottom of a river with cement around your feet. And in families, it can be like that. You can do something that you're out for, and if you do it, you're really out, and it takes a long time to get back in. These are families where, like 20 years ago, somebody's done something, and they still remember when this happened. Okay? Some of you know that. Okay. Let's see. Here, the members are dependent on each other for validity. There's not a lot of room for individuality because they're so connected in that way. And again, if you bump it, they sort of go all over the place again. And it handles the bumping a little less well because once the system is messed up, it doesn't tolerate that very well. And it has to scurry around to get back in order. So it doesn't feel comfortable to kind of have, I don't know, the normal type of relationship. Okay, let's think about some families. What questions? All right, let's look at chaotic disengagement for just a second. Let's think about some families that are like that. Think of TV families, movie families, all kinds of things that are like that. I can tell by my stunning lecture, they're just responding, spitting these things out.
Which one are we discussing?
Chaotic disengaged. This quadrant right here.
How about all in the family?
All in the family. Let's come back to that one. Simpsons, thank you.
Very good. Good answer.
Why? Okay, let's ask the question. Why would the Simpsons be an example?
I've never watched it.
Has anybody ever got anything done in that family?
No,
I don't think so. They eat a lot. They go their separate ways. There's big problems. No one ever addresses them.
They lose the kids.
They lose the kids. That's right. The kids sort of just like do whatever, you know, says anything, does anything, whatever. Sort of all over the place. You know, watch the show. Doesn't make anybody else nervous. You watch that, you think, Okay, Married with Children is another one of those great shows, which is sort of like that. Everybody's just sort of, you know, all over the place. It's crazy. You feel like it's going to fall apart as a family. If you feel like it's going to fall apart, the people are sort of just not even a family. They're just sort of like some people who just happen to be in a room together with each other eating dinner. You probably got the right idea. So they have no influence in each other's lives, really. It's not a relationship, so you can't ask people to change or be different or to relate with you. It's not a safe place because you really don't know the people there. Okay, let's go over to the chaotic mesh, the small town, the right here. No, don't say my family. Roseanne. Who is this? Can we have a plan here? Yes, that's great. Okay, why would you say Roseanne?
Well, it seems like they are dependent on each other for survival. You know, if one's not making it to Roseanne, you know, like every other week, it's like, you know, one of the parents or the kids or somebody.
Right.
And you can never discern who's really in charge.
That's right. And so good they're emotionally point. Dependent on each other. But when you ask, how do things get done, you say, I don't know. You know, it just sort of is all over the place. Mermaids, I'm going to give you some others. Mermaids, Moonstruck, the color purple, death of the salesman. And again, problems pile up, they never get resolved. They're dependent on each other, but really just...
The movie Mermaids is a good example of the role reversals in this kind of a family. In that movie, the daughter is more of a parent than the mother is. The mother's going out, sleeping around, and out of control, and the daughter is thinking through questions about meaning in life and cooking for her little sister.
Yeah, that's very often they have this whole role reversal thing.
So what about the movie Mermaids?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Good. Where would that fit in? He's playing, I'm telling you, moving right along to the next category. Rigid disengage. Okay? There, the roles are very clear, okay? But they can't connect. And you see that movie, it's painful, because they try to connect. Do you remember a scene? There's a scene in that where the son comes downstairs for breakfast, and Mary Tyler Moore, I don't know what her name is in that, but however, think of Mary Tyler Moore. She's made him French toast. And so she says, look, it's your favorite meal. And he's just like, I'm not hungry. And rather than talk to him or find out why, she just takes the French toast and she goes, okay. And she puts it in the garbage disposal and throws the garbage disposal on. She doesn't want to know, like, why or what's going on with you, or they don't talk. And then when the child leaves, I think the parents fight, because then her husband is angry about the way she's treated the son. But they don't really talk about that either. So you have like all these distant kind of...
They don't really fight. It's more of a touch.
Yeah, they really don't. They don't ever connect on it. It's a sad movie. It's sad. And again, we're talking about extremes here. We're trying to give you the model, so don't... You know, you say that was a little like, you know, The Father and the Sound of Music. Okay? Remember that? Had that little whistle? That little whistle, and the kid flying on the motor pipe, you know?
No, sir!
That whole kind of idea, you know? And again, The Father and Mary Poppins. I mean, we got these Disney classic dysfunctional movies. Walt, you have to wonder about what kind of home Walt is. Can you imagine that? And think about this just for a second. We're going to digress for a second, but Walt, you know, the guy was creative, right? Think of him in like this rigid, disengaged family. He's very creative, and he's like into the, you know, Bambi and things, you know, this kind of stuff. And he's in with his family then, you know, cold, distant, rigid. They can do things to him, you know? So this is one of the things we want to look at. Where we're going to move towards is, how does being in this kind of a family affect the kids who grow up in that family? And when I went through this originally, I was embarrassed to be in the room, to be perfectly honest. Because some of these things, I was just like, oh my God, I do some of these. I do some of these things, and I can see myself in the family that I grew up in some of these areas. And for purposes of presentation, you know, we make it real clear, like, this is this. But sometimes you see yourself in different areas, or maybe two different areas. And so that's what we're going to try to get out of this. But it's real interesting. Okay, let's see. The last one is the rigid and mesh, the mafia one. The Godfather? That's good. That's good. If you want to follow the Disney theme, you can go with the Little Mermaid. Okay, that father, she tried to do different stuff, and he was like, but he's still very close. The Jacksons, perhaps. Michael is the sensitive boy, and it's not worked for him. Pat Boone, perhaps. And Ruth said The Great Santini, and she'll have to tell you about that. I'm not really sure.
You guys seen that movie, The Great Santini? It was out in early 80s, maybe? The guy's an ex-Marine, or maybe still a Marine. And he's an alcoholic. He's very intrusive into the lives of his wife and children, but in a very controlling... I mean, he runs his home like he runs the men beneath him in the military.
Right.
That's a real good example of that.
Yeah, so this again, emotionally, they're real close, okay? But in terms of the rules, well, they're real rigid with the rules, too, so it's close and rigid. All right, any questions about that? Because this takes a little bit to think about in terms of thinking about this. I remember the first time it was presented to me, and I still was a little, maybe I'm a little slow with this.
Would you call the bottom right thing the mafia of the rigid admit?
That's okay. That's okay. If you remember, just come back with it. Okay. That's about it.
Okay.
Oh, anyway, would you call that coerced admission?
Mm-hmm. Probably coercion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of coerced that you were a family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not.
It's that you're enmeshed because you were a family.
That's right. True, because it is definitely not a volunteer. The things we talked about, the mafia and the military, we've been making military allusions. Both of those, you don't ask people to do things. And you don't ask people to participate, right? You just basically say, look, we're going to march up this thing and you're going to go with us. And in the mafia, you know, you either do it or there's some kind of a problem that results in it. So that's one of the ways you can think about how your family of origin was, just think about the feelings that these things would generate, and then think about growing up, how that was for you. And you can probably get some good idea from that of somehow how you fit. Mm-hmm. Right.
Obviously, as you get to the ends of the continuum is where it's most unhealthy. So there can be too much of closeness, too much of a good thing. People at this end, yeah, they're very close, but it might be in an intrusive or coercive way. I want to talk now about parenting styles, and then we're going to try and fit them into this. There's been three styles identified by researchers over 20 years. And there were some real shifts in parenting strategies from the 50s to the 60s, and now, you know, in the past several decades. The three that have been identified are authoritarian, permissive, and authoritative. And then there's another, which we call rejecting neglectful, which I see more as an abdication of parenting, almost lacking a parenting style. And we're not going to go into that one much because most of you here wouldn't fit into that category just by virtue of you taking an interest to come to a parenting conference. But we'll touch on it briefly in one of the videos. Okay. Where's that extra paper? Give me one. Thanks. Okay. All right, we'll start off with authoritarian. What does the word connote to you? What do you think of when you hear that word? General, yeah? Yes. Okay. Any other words that come to mind? You say someone is authoritarian? Yes. Very rule-oriented, strict. Okay. In authoritarian families, parents exercise very firm, rigid control. And there's very little verbal give and take between members, between parents and children, for example. This is the kind of family where a parent might say, I want you to do this, and the child would say, why, and what would the parent say? Right, right. So there's no sort of rational reasoning for rules, okay? Okay. These families have very high expectations of their children for maturity and responsibility, and their discipline might be harsh, based primarily on power, such as physical discipline that's harsh, or use of threats. Or it could be just discipline that doesn't make sense. It's you're expected to do it, but you don't know why. You just know you have to. They tend to withhold their children's participation in decision-making, regardless of how old their child is. Children get very little say. There's the saying, children should be seen and not heard. That would be descriptive of this kind of family. And again, there might be very little support or closeness among family members, or they may be very enmeshed, very close, but the relationship is intrusive and or overprotective. All right, now we have permissive families. What do you think of when you hear permissive? Yeah. Okay.
Mother smokes pot with the child.
Excuse me?
Mothers smoke pot with the
child. Yeah, yes, yes. Okay. Okay, these families, they may be warm and affirming with their children. So there are certainly good aspects. As you can see, even up in the authoritarian family, they've got high expectations for their kids. Maybe some good things about each of these. But on the downside, permissive families have very few expectations for maturity from their kids. Well, he's just a child, sort of excuse making. And they give a lot of autonomy to kids in decision making. These are families where, one family, they were trying to decide where to move, and they were consulting their 8-year-old daughter. Now these families do tend to give explanation for rules. They're very democratic. They tend to explain things to their children. And on the good side, then children get a sense that we do things because it's reasonable. There's some rational basis to the world. And then on the downside, the discipline might be laissez-faire. These often parents don't know where their kids are, who they're with. Okay. A saying that might fit with this kind of family would be, I don't want to say no to my children because I don't want to break their spirit. Okay. Then we have authoritative, and these parents combine, I think, the good things from each of these other more extreme styles. They exercise firm control, so there are rules, there are expectations, but they also have high levels of warmth and verbal give and take between parents and children. They're protective and supportive, but they're not intrusive. They're warm. They are involved in their kids' lives. And I think this style really mirrors the stage of adolescence. It's a really good one for the stage of adolescence because you have kids who are no longer children, so maybe they are capable of more and more responsibility, more input in decisions, so you're not going to need to have as much control, but they're not yet adults, so they still need some monitoring, some guidance. So it's sort of a balance. I also think this style really mirrors or is a good connection with the theology, the Christian theology of human nature, in that we see human beings as being created in the image of God and therefore worthy of love and respect and having dignity. But we also see human beings as fallen and therefore sometimes in need of restraint or correction.
Okay. Do you have an example of what is supportive and protective behavior but not intrusive?
Yeah. Say, for example, I have one written down here. Your child wants to go to a movie. You're going to need to know who they're with, when it is, what the movie's about. But you're not going to drive there with them necessarily. You're going to give them some freedom to have some decision making in it.
Or you might give them multiple choices in the movie.
Yeah.
You might say, here's three or four that are acceptable. Which one of these would you like to go to? But these other ones are ruled out in some way. It's the idea maybe of how you would like a boss to work with you. You would like a boss to give you some broad parameters so that you knew you were working on the right things. But if he stood over your desk and watched you,
good point.
You might prefer that they step back a little bit. And it's that idea of spacing, I think.
Yeah. Okay. All right. What would you predict a teen's response to authoritarian or permissive parenting? I mean, think about your own families. If your families tended to be more one or the other, how did you respond in your adolescence to coming from a more strict household versus a more lax?
All their arguments.
Okay, did you all hear that?
To think through all the arguments that you're going to hear from them so that you're ready with your responses. Mm-hmm.
That's that extreme preparedness that was on the other handout. Yeah.
Well, withdraw because you know you're never going to be right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Those both being authoritarian examples. How about permissive? If you were in a family where there was little expected of you, parents didn't really know what you were up to. What might happen there? And as you think about this, the family that you came from, and then think about your own parenting in your current family, sometimes we just, you know, find ourselves doing the same things our parents modeled to us, and sometimes we react and run in the other direction. So you have people come from very strict authoritarian families who end up being very lax and, you know, just run to the other extreme. Okay. Well, in a series of studies over about 20 years, many researchers have found that children of authoritarian and permissive parents lacked competence when compared with children from authoritative homes. Specifically, parenting style was associated with grades from a wide variety of social categories, controlling for sex, age of the adolescent, ethnic background, SES, parents' education level. They found that these parenting processes have an impact on kids over and above all that other stuff. Children from families high in authoritarian or permissive parenting generally got lower grades in high school compared to children from families high in authoritative parenting. Furthermore, authoritative parenting also positively influenced adolescents' attitudes and behavioral indicators of academic orientation. For example, their work motivation, their engagement in classroom activities, their own educational aspirations, their feelings about school, time spent on homework, academic self-concept, and their school conduct. And the researchers found there seemed to be three components of authoritative parenting that were important. The first was supervision and control. The second was autonomy granting. And the third was warmth and acceptance. Okay, first for supervision and control. Parent control that was harsh or based primarily on power or lacking in rationale, or parent control that was laissez-faire, inadequate in monitoring and supervision, or parental control that sort of vacillated, was real inconsistent, which is almost worse sometimes, was associated with patterns of school maladjustment, such as academic failure and adolescent aggression. Second, with respect to autonomy, investigators found that a balanced and gradual involvement of teens in family decisions is optimal. Joint decision-making between parents and adolescents was linked to higher levels of academic performance and other school-related outcomes such as self-esteem, motivation, and the difficult transition to high school. So adolescents who had little opportunity to participate in family decisions, from the authoritarian, you know, they get no say, they had a more difficult adjustment to junior high school than adolescents who had increased opportunities to participate in family decisions. I thought of an example of the balance question you were asking. You may, an authoritative stance may be to say, if you live in our household, we want you to attend church. But you're not going to argue with the kid over what he wears to church. You're going to give the child some autonomy in deciding, sort of a choosing your battles.
No, I wanted to say something about that.
Go ahead.
I'm a parent.
Yeah, go ahead. Chime in.
And, you know, we have these little, I don't know if anybody else has these little battles about church and what they wear. Yeah. And anybody else have that?
Yeah.
And I think that there's boundaries within that, too. Again, there's some things that, you know, they want to wear the shirt that says, you know, death to all pastors. There are a lot of t-shirts and things that are out there that, you know, but I think that the intent is the idea of there is some regulation. You give them some choice of some things, and there's a choice on their side that you're not always getting your own way. I think that's a good indicator. If the child feels like you're always winning, then there's something there that needs to be investigated. And you'll see it, because kids get angry. I think that verse about fathers, and I don't know why it's directed to fathers so much. And maybe it's because, I don't know why, but provoking their children to wrath is a really interesting one. Mm-hmm. And I think it deals with what we're talking about, mm-hmm. where a child is so squashed in some way that there aren't those choices.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Then the other end of the spectrum with autonomy would be to give children too much decision making too soon. And in that case, that was also associated with lower grades with kids. They had too much to handle. So kids that are responsible to cook meals and, you know, to take care of little brothers and sisters at a young age and have a lot of responsibility at a young age. It's too much, too soon. The third aspect was the emotional relationship between parents and teens. Adolescents are maybe more receptive to parental influence when they believe that their ideas are accepted and taken seriously. When they have a sense of warmth from their parents, the attachment bond is strengthened. So family interactions that permit conflict but within the context of a relationship that's supported is going to facilitate positive adolescent development. They've found that parent-adolescent closeness seemed to mediate school outcomes, including general self-esteem and academic self-concept. And in the face of family disruption even, like death or divorce, and it should be noticed, there's some gender differences here, that the positive influence of parental warmth, it seems to be stronger for girls on issues of self-esteem, whereas for boys, for self-esteem and academic outcomes. But for boys, it's on measures of what we call ego development, like responsibility taking, ability to delay gratification, ability to control impulses. So there's sort of different things associated with warmth, gender differences. Yeah.
On the responsibility, Andrew, I always feel like Wendy and our decision is a little bit later than everybody else's. We've given them responsibility, yet it seems all of their friends, I hate that answer too, all of their friends were allowed to do that last year.
Yes.
And we're waiting till this year. Is there a side to err on?
You want to speak to that one, Dad?
I wouldn't let them date till they're 35. No, you know, there's some books that we're going to suggest later on, and one of them is a book by Kevin Huggins. And in the first chapter, he talks about questions like that. And basically what he says there is that, gee, this is a surprise, it depends on the relationship. And basically what he says is that as sinful people, we try to come up with formulas that we put things into, and then we like to then justify whatever we've done by sort of the formula. And then it doesn't
necessitate, which the formulas necessitate not knowing the person. So in other words, we can do away with, I don't have to listen as much, I don't have to work as hard, I don't really have to have a relationship, I can sort of just get this formula and then sort of go on autopilot from there. Mm-hmm. I think that's real interesting. I think that's a very good insight, that things like this are really so individual that you know the kid, you know what they're like, you know what it means to them, you know how ready they are to handle that, and then you know how your relationship is with them also, and you take all those things into account when you do it, and it's just sort of not, well, I don't want to, which I know I find myself sort of, because what happens is a lot of times we get stuck in the situation. They're on their way out the door, or they're way headed somewhere. Oh, by the way, can we do this? And you feel the pull to do it in that quick time. And so we're going to talk about some things later on that set the context for these types of decisions. Mm-hmm. Other times of conversing and talking and doing other things mm-hmm. to set the context mm-hmm. for this. So I hope I haven't dodged that issue, but I think it's a little more difficult than just sort of like a quick rule thing. Mm-hmm.
By summary of some of the outcomes associated with these type of parenting, I'm going to say it in the negative. Simply, that seems to be the way the researchers look at things. Absence of parental warmth is associated with deficits in social skills and self-concept. Makes sense. Okay. Absence of having some autonomy in decision-making with deficits in competence and self-reliance. They're not getting opportunities to start taking on more and more responsibility. And the absence of demandingness for maturity, expectations for maturity, with deficits in impulse control and social responsibility. So if you have low expectations, they'll live up to them. Okay, if we use the grid again, let's try that. And now try and integrate. Where on the grid would you think authoritarian parenting would fit?
This is the final
test. Okay. It would basically just be at the lower end, towards the. We're talking about the kinds of control. And authoritarian families are very strict in their control. Girls from these kinds of families tend to have what we call internalizing disorders, depression, anxiety, eating disorders. They seem to respond to that by going inward. Boys often act out rebelliously against this kind of parenting. You're smiling, John. Yes. So boys have what we call externalizing disorders, such as delinquency, drug abuse, might come to the attention of the law, aggression. Okay. Permissive parenting would be then at the top extreme. And here, low self-esteem is less of a problem because these parents are doing some things very well in terms of being close with their kids. But the maturity gains may be prevented, with teens showing problems with self-control, with responsibility, with ability to delay gratification. Authoritative parenting then would fall right in the middle, with a balance of strictness and laxness. Now, it should be pointed out that you could have authoritarian parenting that's either enmeshed or disengaged. Okay? This is the amount of rules that are there in a family. In the same way up here, you could have very permissive families that are very disengaged and almost neglectful over here or over in this end of things where they are very involved and maybe too much so. Okay. Where would you plot your parents' style on this grid?
Right in the middle. Oh,
yeah. Very good.
You can use the edges of the ceiling tile. Floor tile.
Okay. then where would you plot your own now? Or your spouse's?
Can I help them with this? This is the way that I do it. I sort of look up here and I think, first of all, if your kids, because maybe your kids don't fall into any of those things, like they don't have eating disorders, but they have tendencies, okay? And what you can do is say, where are my kids clustered? What kind of tendencies do I see? Sort of. And then go with whatever category up here which you think makes sense and is probably right. And then you're probably in that category. Like if you read one of these areas and you think they're all together and they're close, but they don't have a lot, but let's see, they're all together and they're close, but they don't talk to each other, so they're disengaged and rigid, and you think that sounds pretty good, okay, then you might be over in that category. Mm-hmm. So whatever category seems sort of natural, I'm mm-hmm. saying to you, mm-hmm. may be the tendency you try to stay a little bit away from. And it's really good to know your tendencies then, because when you're making like a quick decision, this is what I do with myself. I kind of figure, what am I most prone to do? And then I know the side that I'm usually going to err on. And then I can correct. You know how if you're shooting or something and your sight is off a little bit, those of you who shot some, and you know you're a little over to the right, well, I know I got to aim a little bit to the left to be more accurate. Mm-hmm. And that really seems to work, because it doesn't feel exactly mm-hmm. right, so you have to mm-hmm. aim off the center a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you may have a little bit more, different of a style based on the temperament of your child. You may tend to have to be stricter with one child than the other, or to put more effort into displaying affection because the child's more sensitive than another. Yeah.
Parts of your comment there, style and affection. I saw my parents have two different parenting styles. Mm-hmm. I feel that my husband and I have two different parenting styles. Mm-hmm. Permissive versus authoritative. Mm-hmm. And I assume that we can do that. You know, we parent differently. Mm-hmm. But within the family, that sometimes causes conflict. Mm-hmm. The other thing is when you're talking about warmth in parenting, where does physical touch come into that? When you first mentioned it, I thought that's what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Then I thought more conversational effect. Mm-hmm. But does that have an impact?
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, I think it how we touch kids changes over time and how the degree they'll let us touch them. I know in the youth group, the junior high boys love wrestling. And it's sort of a safe way to show affection. So I think it changes over time, but I think it continues to be important. And as a matter of fact, a lot of kids report that their parents pull away from them in adolescence with touch. Especially girls talk about this with their dads, that their dads get nervous around them once their bodies start changing. And the girls experience it as a loss, mm-hmm. wishing they'd still get hugs every once in a while. Yeah. We're going to show a brief video clip that's going to summarize all this again and just give it to you in a little different format. And then Phil's going to do some practical antics.
Why don't you look at him?
And please speak up if you have questions or whatever.
And it, my dad, I'll cut in. But I think with one parent, it would be, there would be no one to stand up for you, and it would just be whatever
you
decide.
Get that out of the way.
And the other parent
might know.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if a parent sees something wrong, the other parent can't also take the same side. And two will be bullying you.
This is not an easy time for parents and their children. The majority of the conflict usually emerges in the early stages of adolescence, particularly because that's the time when the adolescent is really struggling to assert him or herself with a little more independence and self-control and making decisions more independently. And that requires parents then to relinquish the control that they've had in the decision-making process. And that's not easy for some parents to do. Many parents view adolescence as a time of the loss of the relationship with their children. And that's too bad, because it really is a time when parents and children can really begin to work at renegotiating who they are to each other and how they relate. so that it can be a time of change in the relationship and not necessarily a time when parents fear the loss.
Young people who have grown up feeling that it's safe to express themselves openly often act out frustrations, anxieties, and insecurities with their parents instead of with their friends. This can be very disturbing to parents.
Our daughters are highly critical of us and often express their opinions of our beliefs.
We raise them to express their feelings and opinions freely, and they now do it very freely.
So this can be a difficult time for parents to allow their adolescents to be more self-assertive in a quest for independence. It's important for parents to remember that if they have provided children with a good role model and a set of values that they can stand by and the support that they need, those children are going to go forward and make good decisions and be able to reflect the values that parents have instilled. It warrants a good bit of trust from parents to back away and let the adolescents begin to experiment in a safe way with decision-making and self-assertion, sometimes making mistakes and running counter to what parents believe, but holding on to the belief that children will ultimately reflect them in good ways.
These parents are demonstrating the parental style referred to as authoritative.
Authoritative parents are warm and nurturing, supportive parents who encourage independent thinking and good judgment and decision-making in their children by giving rational explanation and by talking with children about their expectations and encouraging them to talk about what it is they do and don't do and what it is that parents want and don't want their children to do and why.
Parents who use an authoritarian style maintain control by being punitive, rejecting, and scolding. To keep an upper hand, they resort often to the use of harsh criticism, interrogation-style questioning, strong commands, and creating feelings of guilt. The children of authoritarian parents tend to be, at one extreme, reticent to stand up for themselves, or at the other, rebellious. They often have low self-esteem, a negative attitude, and lack social competence. Permissive-style parents often form buddy-type relationships with their children. They allow a great deal of freedom and impose few rules. They're not punitive, but they're also not very involved with their children. Male children who are parented in this way may become more assertive, females more responsible. They are also often immature, lacking leadership qualities and self-restraint.
Okay.
Parents whose style of rejecting and neglecting generally are not very emotionally attached to their children and tend not to communicate effectively with them. And as a result, children then may very well reject the parents, may become delinquent, may act out or have difficulty developing good social skills and develop other psychological problems. Parents in the development of their own parenting need to be flexible in a certain way so that early on when children need a more authoritative parent who can be supportive and nurturing but guiding as well, that parents can offer that. But as children grow into adolescence, they really need and want a relationship with parents that can be more democratic, that can be more open to negotiating so that the adolescent can begin to practice asserting him or herself and making decisions in a safe relationship with parents.
I'll go up to my dad and go, can I go somewhere? I don't remember what it was. He goes, if it's okay with your mom. I told my mom, she said it's okay.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Yeah, so
they'll say, you know, go ask the other parent. That parent says it's okay.
Knowing that the other parent is going to say no.
Yeah.
It's a good strategy. I'd use that.
There's no use in that because, I don't know, they'll find out anyway. If I say that my mom's probably going to ask my dad and then he'll say no and then I'll just get in trouble. I won't even take the chance.
Family structure is another factor that influences the amount of conflict that occurs during adolescence. In two-parent families, there is less conflict when parents present a unified front and make it difficult for their children to play them against one another. Adolescents in stable, single-parent families may generate less conflict because they are given more independence and responsibility as a matter of course. Firstborn children and younger adolescents do have more conflict with their parents, But by and large, the association of adolescents with parent-child conflict is overrated.
Well, so far, three times we've been through adolescence, and we have one more to go. But I think that the hardest time around was, the first time around was the hardest time, mainly because we weren't quite sure of what we were doing, and we weren't quite sure how to handle all the issues that were out there that we would have to deal with.
So now that the third one is through with adolescence, we're not even sure of what the fourth one's going to be like, because she's so much younger than the others that it's sort of like starting a new family again.
One authority states that by late adolescence, 80% of families have again found harmony.
Although it's less of a factor than parenting style, societal issues also do have an impact on the adolescent.
Alright, we're going to talk a little bit now about the vitamin C and vitamin E functions. And I hope this will be sort of a practical interaction here, some practical ways where you can up your vitamin C or vitamin E, okay? So if you've noticed a lack in any of these areas, you know, if you're on a nutritional conscious diet, you kind of balance out the things that you don't get naturally. If you didn't get them naturally in your family, where you grew up, you might need to import some, okay? If you've got a sort of a balanced diet from growing up, you might not need to import as many things. So, first thing is, under C, is spend time together.
And we have this on a handout, so
you
can relax.
Everybody relax. Spend time together. There is no such thing as quality time. Do we know that? You know, when you hear these things about people say, I don't spend a lot of time, but I spend quality time. That is so much nonsense that, you know, just take that and shovel it out with the rest of the stuff. It's really ridiculous. And let me explain why. The time that you spend with a child, just like the time you spend in marriage, sets the context for what happens then. You know, when you want to highlight a gem or a stone, what do? They put velvet, you know, those little black velvet things behind it, they shine the light on it. But that backdrop provides the setting for which something beautiful can be shown. In other words, it enhances it. In a marriage or in a relationship with the kids, the time that's spent together, not in conflict, not into teaching them anything, not into, you know, I don't know about you, but sometimes you want to get with your kids and you want to make a point. You know, you're with them and they do something. Now, Johnny, did you realize when you said that? It wasn't exactly, you know. Just spending time together gets them comfortable with you, you comfortable with them. So then when something comes up, you have the context set already. Okay. Second thing is spend time alone with the team. I think this is true of other kids too. I don't think it's just the teens. But good families that I've seen, and I've talked to a lot of parents, and I've tried to incorporate some of this into my family, I said to people, what were the most meaningful things that you've done with your kids? And they've said, times when I've spent alone with them. I'm really not sure of what happens with that. There's families I know that are very good who do things like once a week, even. The father or mother will take one of the children out, and they'll rotate that and do something individually with them. A movie or breakfast or whatever, a variety of things. But that time alone somehow is different than the time that's spent as a family, and I don't know why that is. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think the bonding is a friendship by the parenting relationship. It does build a natural.
Yeah, it does build the context, doesn't it? I mean, rather than just being always the one who intervenes and is punishing or whatever, you're opening yourself up as a person.
And also you have one-on-one time. All your attention and what's important to them is what you discuss, not interrupted by other issues.
That's so true, especially if there's other kids. And what happens sometimes if you have teens in the family is often the teens unwillingly are neglected in some way, because younger kids a lot of times they're very vocal about needing you, and they will tell you, I don't know, I need my homework, tell me my homework, or I need to go here or go there. And a teen, I think, is less apt to say, I need you. What you're going to see is you're going to see it in the body language, in the nonverbal stuff, and you got to sort of read that. So spending time alone. We have some people from Lakeside who work a lot with adolescents too, and I wonder if they want to jump in about time alone or anything like that, jump in along the way, because I know that there's some people who are, we have some experts in the field who have spent a lot of time with kids too. So. Okay, another one is talk about these teens' interests and concerns, and again, listening is the key. Sometimes you're just going to have to bite your tongue. They're going to say things and you're going to want to comment about the type of music, about their ideas about things, about the world as they think it works. And, you know, you want to say something. And it's just not the time. The things that Diane said are so... Yeah, go ahead.
I can't get off of my wire.
Communication is valuable. Get off my cord. You want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a handout that I found by an author named Tori Hayden. She writes fiction for teens. And she just wrote out a list of the kinds of conversations that teens crave, the kinds of topic, things they want to talk about. And it's just some suggestions of ideas of things to ask them.
Now let's say that you've tried some of these and they don't work, okay? What do you do? Because that will happen with some of you. I mean, you'll try to talk to them. Sometimes if the relationship isn't established, you have to go way back. And I would do nonverbal things with them. I would take them to a movie, or I would take them to a batting cage, or I would go golfing, anything that's nonverbal. So you get up to the point where you can go through the verbal stuff. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you're just not going to get the verbal stuff at all in the beginning. And that part. And the interesting thing is, after working with kids, some of the most sensitive kids come off as the hardest to deal with, the most... And there's a lot of fronts that go on. There's a lot of, you know... things that cover up. There's a lot of games with that. So it's a waiting thing sometimes. Okay, here's a big one. Be available when it's inconvenient. My wife is here for a little bit, and she will tell you that my son wants to talk with her right before he goes to bed. I don't know whether he enters this dream state, his defenses are down or something. You know, he's up in bed, he's talking about the world and the universe and meaning. I shouldn't say that about him. Okay, well, you won't buy the steak. But do you know what I mean? There's times when it's not convenient for you. You have places, you have things, places you're supposed to go and things you're supposed to do. And this is where I think you have to go back and talk about where your child is in terms of your priorities. I mean, I hate to say that, but there is no shortcuts. There's nothing here that you can shortcut. You're not going to learn anything today that's going to make it real easy. This is a lot of work. It can help you learn how to do the work, but there's nothing that's going to take the work away. Okay? Amen from anyone. Our manual will be later. All right. Lon, I'll open this by sharing with your child. You have to be careful about this because your reasons for sharing should be investigated. We all have our own issues. And if I feel better at the end of the conversation and they're depressed, maybe something that has happened there that shouldn't be repeated. I mean, you know. We can all know, Johnny, you know, I know it's hard for you, and it was hard for me. Trust your child, assume innocence until you find out otherwise. I had a great example of this the other day. My son went over to a friend's house and was teasing this other kid and took his Predator band and held it over the toilet. I'm totally serious about this. I got a phone call from child's mother. Mr. Predator's mask is missing. We think Mr. Predator's mask went down the toilet. Did your son knock off Mr. Predator's mask while he was holding Mr. Predator over the toilet? And did the mask go down the toilet? Now, my normal inclination is to say yes. Okay, I'm just going to say that. If that, you can put me up on the chart, whatever you like. Guilty. But then I'm thinking, wait a minute. My son is usually pretty good with things, and I've noticed this about him. After talking to him, I noticed he has a lot of these men, and he always knows where they are, and he lines them up, and if they're missing a sword or a gun or something, he knows that they're missing. And if he says there wasn't a mask on the Predator, there wasn't a mask. He's just like that. So I said to the mother, I think you need to look around for that mask, because if he said it wasn't on there, I don't think it's on there. And so she called me back later in the day. She had gone and looked in his room, and it was sitting right in the chair in the room. So I got one. That doesn't always happen. But assume that they can do things too. This is one other story. That we were putting something together in the car that needed batteries or something in it, and I had worked on it for, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes, and I couldn't get the batteries, and I couldn't make the darn thing work. So my son said, let me try. And I thought, oh, this is a good time to teach him. I handed it to him, and I proceeded to lecture him. You know, things in life are tough. Sometimes you think you can do things. You can't really do things. You got to know when you say no. Oh, God. And about 15 seconds, he handed it back to me and said, here. I got to tell you, that has affected me as much as anything. I honestly didn't think he could do it, and didn't think wasn't going to give him opportunity to do it, and he did it like that. So maybe I'm saying to be flexible, be aware that of your child's innocence, and allow yourself to change in terms of thinking with them. Treat your child with respect. What do you want as a person? I want people to respect me. I want them to talk nice to me. I want them to think good things about me. And yet the tone that I've heard parents, and that I've taken myself at times with my kids. I wouldn't wish for a dog. You know, you're in a store somewhere and you hear somebody yell something across or say something in a line or say, you know, it's tough. It really is tough for that child. So treat it with respect. Be supportive. Kids are striving for mastery. They're striving to achieve things. They're struggling to conquer things, to do something well. And so as you're supportive of them, they're able to begin to do those things. You know, they really need that so much. Don't be alienated by gender. You were going to say something about that.
It's just what I mentioned before about the things that girls have reported to me, feeling like especially their dads have pulled away from them in their teen years. And so I think it's good to do same-sex things, moms doing things with daughters, but also cross-gender. The whole idea of daddy dates, I think it's really, girls talk to me about how much that means to them that their dads take them out, do things with them. And girls can become jealous if they see their dads just doing, quote, boy things with the boys. If they feel very hurt about that, they don't ever get asked to the ball games or the fishing trips or.
And that's hard. I mean, I grew up in a family with four boys. And so we had a daughter. What do I do? And so I was the pony for a while. You probably have played games, you know, with the Barbies and things. And I would be the pony. Make the pony run up the hill. And I'm sitting on the floor and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm 35 and I'm sitting on the floor making the pony. The pony goes up the hill. No, Daddy, the pony doesn't go up the hill. The pony stays here. Okay, my pony stays. And you know, and you just do this stuff. And sometimes it's, I don't know, how long can I do this? How long can I be this pony? But anyway, touch them affectionately, play. Go to their events as often as you can. Be kind to their friends. But don't try to be cruel. Well, there you have it. Yeah, this brings out all kinds of things, doesn't it? Because we never want to think that we're older, do we? And even as we are. All right, I'm just going to pass that one by. Okay. Praise whatever you can find that is good in them. You know, whatever things that you find in them that are good.
Yeah. I've got a question. I have a daughter who doesn't like praise. She doesn't. She totally will put anything you say down. Mm-hmm. So how do you handle that?
I would find out what that, I don't know. How old is she?
She's 11.
Unless maybe she can begin to start telling you what that means to her. I mean, sometimes
I'm talking from infant, I mean from young, yeah, from potty training on up. And I thought that it went away for a while, but I just praised her the other day on something and it came back.
that could be a lot of things. Sometimes kids don't believe you.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you tell them things, oh, you're really good at it, and they know, and my son will say this to me, Dad, I stink at that. And I'm trying to tell him how good he is. And he knows I'm bad at it. So what am I? I'm a liar. Mm-hmm. Who's encouraging? Oh no, you're kind of good at drawing that. And he says, Dad, it looks like a horse and it's a dog. Now when you're little, I guess you can get away with that. But as they get older, they begin to realize.
We kind of had a similar thing with one of our daughters. And my husband had read something about painting a picture for the kids, and it's worked well with her. I don't know if it's worth a try with your daughter, but she didn't accept the praise as well. I don't know why. She's our firstborn, so she was a little combative from the beginning, and I don't know because I was afraid of babies when I had her. I don't know what it was. But anyway, he started to paint a picture for her, and she didn't accept the praise for playing the piano well, but he would say, you know, Rebecca, I can picture you playing for youth group and then for the church. And he would also say, you know, I see Donna, she's 24, but when she was little like you, she sounded just like you. And so I can picture you being able to do that. And boy, that motivated her to practice. Mm-hmm. Her playing maybe didn't sound so great. We were just trying to encourage her to keep on practicing. And coming from her father, too, spoke volumes. But I think when it came from me, she thought, well, you just have to do that because you're the mother.
That's an interesting point, but it does mean different things. You're right.
From that's having the vision roots that you spoke about.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you say more about that?
Well, for those of you who weren't at the one this morning, we were talking about with girls, but also with boys, of casting a vision, giving them a hope for what they can do. And it sounds like that's what your husband did very well. He visualizing it.
It really turned her on.
Sort of like Zen tennis or something. Visualize yourself doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, and we all need it.
Well, I was thinking maybe she thinks that she has to be perfect in everything that she does. And there's times that this may sound a little cruel, but I jokingly said, yeah, you're right. You can't do that. And then all of a sudden they say to you, but I did get an A on my
They
test.
Switch back to the other side.
They used to call it reverse psychology, but I don't see it as that. I see it as they're praising themselves. You already know that they can do it. You know, you already know that they're good. But having them validated for themselves makes bigger difference.
Well, and sometimes the truth is that they're not good at things. I mean, one of the hardest things is when you find kids who aren't good at a lot of things, and they're sometimes the hardest because you have a child who, gee, they're not really on sports, they're not really great with that, and they're not good at school, sort of, so, okay, there's those things. And then you have to get real creative, sort of, okay, well, kind of what's out there? And somebody has talked about that. I think Dobson has talked about that. Trying to find something they're good at and catch them at doing something that they do well. You know, almost like, you know, you did that. Oh, that's so
specific. I mean, just as you say, like putting in, like, you know, you really listen to your friends, or you really
tried doing that. Not that what you did was great, but the way you went about it was great. Okay. That kind of thing.
Yeah, and it can be very, you're right, it can be little, I mean, it doesn't have to be like all of school, or it can be just the praise somehow versus the actual thing itself, it can be a little thing itself.
Somebody who's overly self-critical would be the person who wouldn't accept the praise.
Mm-hmm.
Who would say, oh, I didn't hold that note long enough.
Mm-hmm.
I did screw that up.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was great, you know,
mm-hmm.
but I fouled that up. And you're just lying to me because you
right.
think that it was great.
And there you got to get in there with them and find out what's going on. Because no amount of encouragement, that's like Teflon, you know? The encouragement is not going to stick to them because they know what's going on in a sense better than you do. And you're saying, oh, you're good at this or you're good at that or whatever. It's just, it's not staying there.
That's just one drop of ball in baseball,
mm-hmm.
and there could be no good from there.
You know,
I mean, to their own.
Yeah, the pressure the kids are under today, honest to goodness, we should say something about this in general, is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
They have so many ways to fail. You can fail in relationships with girls or guys. You can fail at school. You can fail at each one of the subjects. You can fail in sports. You can fail. You wear the wrong types of shoes to school. And you're made fun of for the whole rest of your high school days. So there's this incredible pressure, an incredible sense that you can fail at any time. It's a lot of pressure. Let's go on here. How to set rules. Explain the rules. I would not explain the rules a lot. There's a time when you explain rules, and there's a time when you're explaining, and it ruins your authority. Okay? You know? And I don't know how you tell that, except when you start getting annoyed, and you've explained it a couple times, maybe time to move on. Be consistent. Okay? They talk about the executive function, like the executive committee in terms of parents, and it's almost like both parents are on the committee, and let's reach a decision together in some way. Now, here's what happens often. It's like a boat. You know, somebody who gets up on one side, and to balance it out, the other person gets up on the other side of the boat. And so you might have tendency permissive and sort of authoritarian. And the funny thing is that the further you go to balance, you see how you get further and further away? And so in some sense, you have to gear down maybe step by step and reach some resolution, some of those. Often, and we didn't talk about this, but often conflicts between parents are played out in this executive functioning area. So if you're running into huge conflicts in this area, a good thing to do is to back up and say, wait a minute, what's going on between my husband or my wife and I? And let's deal with that and keep the kids out of it in some way. Okay. Involve teams in decision making as you can. Know where to draw the line. Choose your battles, okay? Balance control with independence. You want to say something about the...
Yeah.
Can you scroll it up?
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think it's important to make a distinction here. We're talking about giving more decision making. You want to continue to monitor your children on a behavioral level, knowing their whereabouts and who they're with and all that. But you want to give more psychological control as they're getting older. So, you know, the comment about dress, for example, maybe there's some bottom line, like you're saying, bottom line standards, but it's not good to say, you know, to be getting into arguments over how they're wearing their hair. It's more important that you know where they're at, who they're with, what time they're going to be home, that kind of being on top of their behavior, but giving them some decision making about their lives.